Okay, this is talking with Ed McClain at his home in Morningside, Maryland on 22nd December, 73. Well, tell me a little bit about your beginnings in NRL and so forth.
Oh, I started in 42, right after World War II. Everybody, of course, was looking for something to do in his field, and I had 2.5 years of school at that time, so I had a friend who had a friend who was working at NRL, and during Christmas vacation we applied for jobs, were hired, and stayed there all during the war, and until I retired, actually, 26 years in total. And originally worked on 3-centimeter radar, built the first 3-centimeter radar the Navy ever had, I guess. Turned up down on Chesapeake Bay. Tested a lot of production radars that were coming out and that sort of thing all during the war. After the war, I was...
By the way, did you ever hear of any solar interference on any of these radars?
No, but like a lot of other people, we tried to radar the moon. I remember one night we went out with this the first commercial 3-centimeter radar, which had a power up of a peak power, I guess, of about 100 kilowatts. And without any calculations or anything else, we just simply pointed it at the moon and sat back and waited to see if we could see anything and pointed on and off the moon, one thing or another. But if you put the numbers in the equation, it doesn't come out. You know, we had little 3-foot transmit and 3-foot receive antennas, and there's just too much loop loss to have begun to detect it. But a lot of people did this, I think. Now, Hagen started playing around with the sun in the late 40s. Well, I guess almost immediately after World War II. And of course it was no trick at all to take a radar receiver and point it at the sun and see it rise in the grass on the A-scope. But I didn't really get into radio astronomy until right after Ewan and Purcell did their work on the hydrogen line. I'd been working on aircraft navigation systems, Doppler navigation systems, where you point a couple of 3-centimeter RF beams at the ground and measure the velocity vector along those beams, and then put it in a computer and come out with true ground speed. And
why two beams?
Well, in order to solve the vector equation, we had two beams that were canted 20 degrees out from the signal axis and 20 degrees back. So
they're in different axes, yes.
Yeah, so you get, coupling that, say, with an altimeter, you get the full solution of your position. And so we got, I guess it's called an instrument to build a computer, take altitude, roll, bank, pitch, and plus the two velocity components off these RF beams, and you could start out in Washington, fly over the airfield, crack any latitude and longitude, fly down to Caribbean, you'd be within about 1% of your position. So there was also a competing Air Force project that we got involved in a lot of committees, a lot of hassle back and forth, but got to go catch the watch. So in the, I guess started working on this. Well, I'd done some work on it all during the war. It was a real low priority project during the war, and then by 51 or so, it had gotten to the point where we went into a pilot production run on it and wrote up specs with the Bureau of Aeronautics and let out a pilot production contract, and we, NRL more or less backed out of it. But now I understand that Bendix and General Precision Laboratory and probably other companies actually have these things flying on airliners, and of course military uses them. And
same basic principles,
gratifying piece of work. It worked pretty much the way we hoped it would, and you know, you come out with a 70-80, we figured we'd get under 100 pounds with it. We were in business. You could put it on a Navy fighter plane, maybe a one that would lead a squadron, so he could keep everybody knowing where they were. But anyhow, it's been in commercial production for years and years now. But anyhow, while I was doing all this, people like Fred Haddock and John Hagen were playing around with radio astronomy, because after the war, it became pretty generally recognized that a lot of our success in World War II had been due to a rather solid scientific base, and the swing then was to go away from applications and engineering, you might say, applied science, if you will, back to some basic investigations that might in future years pay off the way such work had done prior to World War II, or in World War II. So Hagen, I guess, was the one who really, he had a tremendous knack for being able to sit back and look ahead and figure out what was going to pay off. He was a real good poker player. And Fred Haddock was pretty much in the same boat, and the two of them got very interested in solar radio astronomy, went on several eclipse expeditions.
Yeah.
Connie Mayer, for example, went on
I've talked with Connie, so he's told me details about those.
So these fellows were running off around the world while I was working on my automatic navigator, and I didn't pay too much attention to what was going on until Harold Ewan discovered the hydrogen line, and Hagen took me up to Boston with him to check over. Well, Hagen decided he was going to have Ewan build him a receiver. So he took me up there to get checked out on it, and as a result of that, I spent about a year and a half, not exactly redoing Doc's work, but adapting the thing to work on the 50-foot telescope at NRL, and also trying to get the 50-foot telescope to work, because, as you probably know, it was put on it was a beautiful mirror, but it was put on a twin 5-inch gun mount.
Right.
Well, a gun mount is made to operate with very low moment of inertia at very high velocity, and of course we had the moment of inertia up maybe 100 times mm-hmm. over a couple of 5-inch gun barrels, and the drive system just wasn't compatible with the mass it had to move, and the
yeah.
darn thing would hunt. So they put in 9-to-1 reduction gears. That didn't solve the problem, so first thing, Joe Nichols and I spent, must have been 6-8 months, building some Dutchman, I guess you'd call them, a box to go between the other black boxes to try to quiet this thing down, which we finally succeeded in doing. And in the meantime, we were working on Ewan's receiver, trying to get it adapted to the 50-foot dish.
Why do you call it a Dutchman?
It's just an old machinist expression. It's a piece that goes between two other pieces to make up for somebody's mistakes.
I haven't heard that.
Anyhow, you knew Bob Meyer, didn't you?
No, I didn't. He retired just before I... No.
Well, that was Bob's favorite expression. Anytime you had to fix something by that method, you had to go make a Dutchman.
Let me just ask you, do you happen to know which ship those gun mounts came from?
I haven't the slightest idea. Yeah. No. They came from the Navy Yard, I'm sure. See, the Navy used to make all their own guns, the mounts
yeah.
and barrels and everything else, right down here in Washington. And they came out of stock there. As a matter of fact, one thing we had to keep doing over the years was to scrounge old gun mounts that people were going to throw away to get spare parts for that one.
Oh, yeah.
And I guess it's still operating.
Yeah.
Joe knew everybody in the country, I guess, that had any spare gun mount parts. And as a matter of fact, a real good friend of mine right now, who I see almost every Sunday morning, was working at the Navy Yard on those gun mounts along in the late 40s and early 50s. Fellow by the name of Fleming Shaw.
What?
And there's another fellow by the name of Joe Dybrack who was, they were, you know, just couple of guys. It's one of these things, like you were talking about the measures, when the father mm-hmm. goes away, the measure's in
yeah.
trouble, and the same way on a gun mount. The talent disappears, and you want a gun mount worked on, you're in dire straits.
Yeah.
And there's only a couple of guys in the country that we had access to that weren't even working on the Navy anymore that we could get to come in and work on a contract basis to help someday. But finally, Joe got well enough versed that he could keep it going. But anyhow.
Well, but what about the dish itself? I mean, that was a rather large thing for that time.
Oh, it was. Fantastic job.
Who actually designed that and so forth?
Well, the contract was left to, well, the idea, of course, was John Hagen. There's any question about that. As I say, he had a remarkable talent for knowing which direction to go.
And the aim was, what was the original purpose?
Well, we in the branch during the war had been highly talented in the centimeter wave range, 10 centimeters and up. We'd worked on 10, 3, and 1, or, 8 millimeters even. And, nobody else in the world was working at these short wavelengths. We didn't know what was there, but Hagen figured, you know, this is something to do that nobody else is doing, and we did have the facilities and the money and the talent to pursue
mm-hmm.
it. So he made this choice, and you have to give him credit. It was a credible choice.
Yeah.
So this was also at just the right time, because the Navy was telling NRL to go do some basic research. Keep yourself well-founded, grounded in the basics,
right.
So don't worry about building radars for us or building
mm-hmm.
this or that or the other thing necessarily. Put at least 50% of your effort on basics. Of course, you know, the other 50% kept on trying to advance applications,
yeah.
keep the fleet up to date and all this sort of thing, but we were fortunate to be in one of the branches that was assigned a basic research mission, and it was radio astronomy. So the Hagen's objective was to get a very high quality mirror at centimeter wavelengths, at the wavelengths we knew, and find out what
right.
was there. Well, obviously there was a devil of a lot more there than we ever found out with that mirror in those early days, but
Well, but
we had no way of knowing. It's a thing where you didn't have the equipment available. For example, you didn't have measures which could get down below 100 degrees at 3 centimeters, things like this. So, contract was let to Collins Radio Corporation out in Cedar Rapids, strangely enough. And what they did was, I've forgotten how many castings there are, but they had a large number of aluminum castings, which were edge machined and pinned and bolted together. Then they built a huge boring mill over this assembly of castings and ground cut the surface.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it had F over D or something like that. I think it's 0.5, which is rather long for these days.
Yeah.
But it also has some advantages. If you don't worry about ground radiation, it's very easy to feed. But anyhow, they machined this thing, and then they disassembled it completely and shipped it here, casting by casting, and then reassembled it on the roof down there. And, it would work at 8 millimeters. The only trouble was, being castings, there were heavy webs in behind each, periodically across the surface, there would be a heavy, deep section of aluminum. And if you had a temperature change during the day, say, these webs would soak up the heat or slow down the change in the region that they affected. And we got some very nice photographs of frost on the thing. When the frost started to melt, you could see the webbing in behind the surface.
Hmm.
So that at 8 millimeters, it wasn't all that good unless you had a stable temperature situation. But Hagen did make quite a few measurements with and Haddock at 8 millimeters, I think, on the sun.
I think that was all they did, wasn't it? Just about, I think, up until the time
that the hydrogen line business came along, because he had all this pointing trouble. You couldn't make the darn thing point and stay there without hunting.
Right, but I mean, any source other than the sun or moon, for 8 millimeters, it was a long time later.
Oh, yeah. It was used. My point was that it was actually
used at
8 millimeters on the sun and moon. And if I'm not mistaken, I think the phase effect on the moon was... Gibson was working on this, and I think that was done with a 50-foot dish, perhaps. I'm not positive.
Well, Pennington and Minute did a study in 48 at K-band.
That's true.
I'm not sure when Gibson's was. I think Pennington.
But I think their resolution was way down compared to the
in angle.
Resolution.
Right.
Gibson's
work was the first to show differences across the surface.
Essentially, you look at the Terminator, and you could see the phase changes and lags and one thing and another. Anyhow, it greatly reinforced the dust theory, I'm sure, and I don't know whether the boys, when they landed, found out it was all that dusty or not, but it worked like dust anyway.
Yeah, right.
So that was a major thing that had been used for up until, you started on this hydrogen line business.
So that was what period?
It started in about 52, and I guess in 53 we really got the antenna so we could point it where we wanted to, and we had the receiver that we bought from Ewan, pretty well adapted to the dish and ironed out some bugs in one thing or another. We made a decision to put the consoles over in one building, and the dish was over in the other building, so we had the business of feeding 1400 megacycle local oscillator power all the way across and getting the IF signal back. A lot of problems, just nitpicking problems, really, but it took time to solve. Anyhow, we got in business sometime in 53, I guess. And
let me just ask about Ewan's receivers. Everyone talks about getting his receivers. What was so special about them?
He'd done his original work, if I remember correctly, with a frequency switch system.
Right.
But he got this hot idea that the way to go was what he called DC comparison radiometer, which was a non-switch system, and so you essentially were utilizing total power, and which gave you the edge on sensitivity, and then you just compared a wide band of noise against a narrow band of noise on the line. And the only trouble was that the amplifiers would amplify a wide band of noise in a little bit different fashion than they would a narrow band of noise. It's very difficult, for example, to get a video amplifier to amplify a 2 megacycle bandwidth without the occasional peaks overloading the stage. In other words, that'd be operated at a very, very low level in order to keep it linear. So you had some linearity problems. This was part of the work we were involved in over maybe a year to 18 months or so, trying to get these bugs out so we could believe what we saw. Hey, turn that down, please. It was just another way of doing a thing. Not as satisfactory, I'm sure, at this point, as frequency switch.
But,
nobody knew in those days what was going to pay off the best.
So he had spent the most time thinking about it.
Ewan kind of went into business for himself. He sold these things to the lab, and after discovering the hydrogen line, strangely enough, he didn't lose interest in radio astronomy, but he went into it from a kind of a businessman's point of view and built some pretty good equipment from time to time for various projects, not only radio astronomy. But that's the route he went, and I think a lot of people thought less of him for it, but everybody's in their own kicks.
Really?
Anyhow, this was the beginnings of his company, you might say. So, along with 53, we got on the air with the hydrogen line receiver. It had a proper feed and the antenna and everything. And one of the first things that we found, or I guess I found it, but Hagen and I were working together, and I showed it to him, and he wasn't too impressed, and then both of us got confused over it and looked at the center of the Milky Way, and it didn't look right. Instead of being a nice round profile, as you might expect, the thing was depressed in the middle.
As you let it drift through, you mean? Yeah.
Well, either drift through or stay right on the center and scan through it. It had structure in it that, well, to me, I was no astrophysicist at the time, and of course, it's perfectly easy to figure out how hydrogen absorption works after the fact, but, you know, we weren't looking for it.
Right.
And we had these profiles that were depressed in the middle in a rather fine structure, something like 5 kilometers a second, a narrow feature. But
you only had a single channel at this time.
Only had a single channel, and we could scan it either in position or scan it in frequency. But, and we narrowed the bandwidth down to make sure that I built a special IF bandpass filter to make sure we weren't losing anything, and it was indeed narrow. The 5KC filter apparently resolved it, but that was about what it was 5 kilocycles, which meant, you know, it was right down thermal. Something pretty, turned out later, pretty cold in front of it. So, but there was a rather unfortunate for us situation. The 50-foot dish, the antenna temperature, on the galactic center, was of the right magnitude such that with total absorption you just about come down to zero.
Oh yes.
And the fact that the thing didn't go below zero, you see, didn't give us the clue that we needed. Had the thing actually backed
negative,
up and gone below zero, there would have been no other explanation.
Right.
So, there was some criticism of the way we handled it, I guess, but well, no excuses, really. We didn't know what we had.
Yeah.
There were some bright boys around who told us it was absorption, but if it had gone below zero, you could have believed it, you know, and we went all the way from balls to stars in the center of the Milky Way to fantastic things. You know, we just didn't know. But anyhow, this went on for some time. I became convinced it was absorption. I talked to Ed Lilly, and we spent quite a few hours discussing the possibilities and particularly the absorption part of it. And I was pretty thoroughly convinced it was absorption. I don't know whether Hagen was or not, but anyhow, the original detection of the thing was already published, so there wasn't anything
well,
about
did,
that.
Did you talk with Lilly before the first paper?
Oh, no. The first paper.
That probably just came out quickly as soon as you...
Yeah, that's right. It was one of these things. You know, we published it.
Although I think in the first paper, if I remember correctly, it says you acknowledge conversations with George Field, a young
that's
graduate
right,
student at that
right.
time.
George was at Princeton, and George visited us. Now, there was something peculiar about this, and I can't recall what it was. Whether George suggested that it was absorption, or whether I'm thinking about something entirely different. There was some kind of a hassle with George Field. I don't remember what it was, though.
He doesn't say. It just acknowledges discussions with him.
Well, we had discussions with him, but...
So anyways, at the time, you did consider absorption, but for the first quick paper, you decided the other was...
This may have been what George suggested and what we ignored. I just can't recall for sure. But the thing just kind of hung fire for a while. We had published the fact that we'd found this peculiarity, and people got interested. Quite a few people came by and talked to us. The guy's head of the department out of Indiana.
Mm.
Get a Christmas card from him every Christmas. This guy
Edmondson?
Edmondson.
Yeah.
Edison came by, and he was real interested in about this thing, and we talked to a lot of people. And but again, just the fact that there was a depression that didn't go below zero, nobody could prove anything, you see.
Yeah.
And we weren't as bright as we ought to be, I guess, but...
well, you were an astrophysicist.
You know, I wasn't certain. Man, I don't feel guilty about it at all. Anyhow, we detected the damn thing. This started the ball rolling.
So this was completely independent of what was done at Jodrell Bank a few months later, when they got absorption also.
No, he's thinking of Holland.
No, Davies and Williams.
Oh, no, Bank. It was contemporary. It was contemporary, but I've always had a bit of a suspicion that... we got a visit from them between the time we made... we're mixing apples and peaches. Galactic Center absorption. No one else.
Right. But I'm just talking about absorption.
Now, let's get on to the real absorption story. The Galactic Center was hanging fire. We thought it was absorption, I guess, by the time Ed Lilly came down. At least Ed Lilly and I did. But Ed came down in about July of 54, I believe. And he and I were both convinced it was absorption, and so he and Hagen and I were working, and we finally got around for some, I don't know why we waited so long, we finally got around looking at Cassiopeia. And I'll never forget that night, because we had the thing set up, and it took about 30 minutes to run a profile, and had the thing all set up, checking Cassiopeia, and the damn pin comes along, and starts dropping, and it drops, and it drops, and it drops, and I'm watching, and I says, my God, we've got a hole.
Yeah.
And, you know, well below zero. Not only one, but two well below zero, and a third one, if I remember right.
Right.
Just breaking the line. Well, this set off about a month and a half or 2 months of panic head scratching. And we were convinced it was absorption, but it's real easy to see in hindsight, of course, that obviously the only thing it can do any absorbing is the very small column directly in front of the radio source. But at that time, it's not so easy to see, and it was quite some time before, I went to work on the receiver. We were worried that maybe this was some kind of a processing phenomena in the receiver itself, you see. Nobody had worked out the equations of how the receiver worked. So I went to work on that, and that appeared as Appendix A in that paper.
Oh, yeah.
Ed Lilly and I scratched our heads, and he did most, practically all the work, I guess, on the mechanism. And finally, you know, between the three of us, I know at one time I showed Hagen how the receiver worked, and he told me I better go back and go back to my desk because I had it all wrong. He said, there's a factor two missing somewhere. I remember that real well. I said, no, John, this is the way it works. It's got to be. There's no factor two missing. There's something happening. Well, I don't know who's really responsible for what, but anyhow, it finally dawned on us. And we were all three convinced that what was happening was that there was a small column of absorbing gas cooler than the radio star, Cassiopeia, and that there was fine structure in this gas, as there obviously would be in a narrow column like that, and that there were three
giving
very
narrow features,
intense absorption features across the profile associated with the spiral arms. Well, this really set off a Donnybrook, because... who were the two guys at Caltech, the really experts? Bodden Minkowski,
yeah.
Bodden Minkowski had just determined that Cassiopeia was, I believe, at 500
parsecs.
That's
right, yeah.
And, of course, once we understood what we had on the chart paper, it was perfectly obvious, if anybody believed Oort's model of the galaxy, that it wasn't 500 or 800 parsecs, it was about 2,500 parsecs,
right,
beyond the third spiral arm. So... this was something else. And,
you're on a collision course.
You know, with two of the top experts in the optical business, at least.
Right.
So I'll never forget, I think it was the 100th meeting of the Astrophysical Society at Princeton. And Botta and myself and Fred Haddock, Botta came to me and wanted me to explain to him what was going on, how this thing worked. You know, I didn't feel so bad then because I figured an optical astronomer ought to understand absorption upside down and backwards, and we'd already published, I believe, at that point in the Astrophysical Journal and completely laid the thing out with showing how the fine structure in the gas could cause these deep absorption holes and how the thing actually was a tool of immense resolution because the angular dimension you were working with was the dimension of the star itself, the radio star, radio source. So anyhow, Botta and I... Bobby got a hold of me and wanted to know if I would go over this with him. So we went over in Spitzer's office, and he and Fred Haddock and I were there, and I got up on the blackboard and laid the whole thing out for him. And I'm sure Bada, at that point, didn't really understand it either. Because he kept saying yes, and he gave all appearances of understanding it, but really, I don't think he appreciated the power of the tool.
Yeah.
Because
the fact that it wasn't your beam.
He was used to classical methods, yeah. And I seriously doubt that he expected, really, to have his and Minkowski's distance proved wrong. By irrefutable evidence.
By such a large factor, yeah.
And by such a large factor. So this was a real interesting session with Bada anyhow, and he apparently grew to be very fond of me and I of him, because he reminded me a great deal of my grandfather. He was a German, of course, and he had a limp, which my grandfather broke his leg, and he had a limp, and they looked alike. And I told him, I said, you're a dead ringer for my grandfather, who I thought very much of him. And every time I'd see him at a AAS meeting, he'd always come up, we'd have pleasant words and conversations. Well, it was sometime later. I can't tell you the exact date, but I have the letter encased in plastic upstairs. I got a letter from Bada. And he says, either we or I or Minkowski, I forgot which one of them, have just redone our work on the distance to Cassiopeia. And I have come to the conclusion that we could not see the forest for the trees, that the object is covered by dust, and that we were not seeing all of it, that it is much larger than we thought it was, and that the distance is indeed 2,500 parsecs,
yeah.
And I thought you would like to be the first to know.
is the thing
of which, in all the dealings I have had with radio astronomy, the thing of which I'm proud, proud, because this was certainly,
right.
He was a prince of a man and a real first-class astronomer. To get a letter like that from somebody,
right.
It's something you cherish all your life. But anyhow, this at the same time, England, the people in England did.
Williams Davies,
yeah. Published a paper which I really never understood. And I think if I read it again today, I wouldn't quite understand. Have you read it?
Oh, yes, yeah. I think I understand.
Do you understand it?
Yeah.
Well,
let's not go into it now. Maybe afterwards in detail.
But what didn't you understand? Well, I just didn't understand what they were getting at, how they were proving that this was taking place. They didn't have any absorption profiles.
They had difference profiles.
Between
on and off.
I guess I didn't understand them like Bada didn't understand ours, It's that sort of thing. I'm not saying that what they said wasn't legitimate. I'm just saying I didn't understand it.
Because indeed they did come up with about 3 kiloparsecs.
I know. And it was after they had been over and had a talk with us, I might add. And I'm pretty sure we'd shown them our profiles. I can't swear to that, but I know they'd been there. And I know Ed Lilly and myself and John Hagen always kind of wondered, if maybe we'd let the cat out of the bag. But.
Yeah.
Regardless, it's all part of the game.
But at that stage, though, were you aware of the possibilities for getting distances?
Oh, yeah, as soon as we recognized for sure what our mechanism was, when they questioned about the distances.
Because in the paper for the large paper, Lilly, McLean, and Hagen, I don't think there's anything in there about distances.
Well, there's a distance to Cassiopeia.
Is there? Okay.
Well, it's laid out 2,500 parsecs.
Maybe my memory is.
You're talking about the Hagen Lilly McLean paper.
That's right. You're right.
Now, the first paper on Galactic Center, there was nothing on distance.
You just give a profile.
Yeah,
profile. That's right.
You can't be very proud of that first paper, but the second paper laid it all out.
Right, but then Williams and Davies' paper was published before the second paper.
Perhaps true, but I don't know.
And they gave a distance estimate. And then yours.
Ours was in publication, I'm pretty sure. And like I say, they had.
And you say they visited.
They did visit us.
Okay.
This is not to imply anything underhanded or anything else, but I really never did understand what they were saying.
Okay. Well, I can maybe tell you a little bit about it. Afterwards, as I remember anyway.
But anyhow, as far as I'm concerned, that original paper in the Astrophysical Journal on Cassiopeia absorption laid the whole thing out for anybody else that ever wanted to work on it.
Sure, that's a basic paper.
It was complete, even to the description of the receiver, which showed exactly how that operated. There was no question for anybody to ask from that moment on. But it was hard or boring. I mean, it wasn't easy, and it took a matter of 2 or 3 months, I guess, before we were sure that we'd covered all the bases.
Yeah.
And Well, the Dutch came out right shortly after that with a similar set of profiles, and they were able to get good profiles on Taurus, which they had a little bigger dish than we did.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a paper that was most usually quoted on absorption.
Mueller's paper.
Mueller's paper. Yeah. But...